KDLL Public Radio provides the news, interviews, features, and entertainment programming you trust from around the world and right here at home. Do you value local, responsible reporting or diverse music brought to you by your friends and neighbors? How about in-depth shows that are unique to your community? Then please support KDLL. We can't continue to bring you the local programming you enjoy without your support. Please visit kdll.org and click the donate button today.
And I really did want to step back and get to the very basic and just start there. What is the purpose of an in-stream flow reservation? What does that do?
You know, we do two things with the volumes and the molecules of water in our freshwater streams in Alaska. One variety is we actually have applications pending where people ask for a water appropriation. And a water appropriation is where a company, usually a mining company, but it can be another type of company, wants to take water out of a stream. And there's a process for that. And then there's what we call in-stream flow reservations, where people are applying to make sure that a certain percentage of the water in any particular stream is left in the stream for a particular purpose. And, you know, what we've done here in the state is we've dealt with these issues over time. And just because we still live in a very young state and we haven't had a lot of situations where there was conflict, we've not really had to deal with issues where you have development over requests for in-stream flow reservations. And so this is something that, you know, I'm convinced the state of Alaska needs to take a very close look at and really think about what we want to do with our water, because it's really critical for conservation purposes. It's really critical for salmon, and it's also very important for industry as well to have access to water.
Sticking with that, mentioning the idea that that there's maybe some work for the legislature to do regarding some of these issues, what are some things that you would like to see the legislature take a look at or possibly consider?
Well, I think that, you know, the good news in all of this is that we as a state have relatively clean water, and we are at the front end of many of the decisions that probably need to be made. In many other Western states, they have something which is a water resources board. And it's a board that is semi-independent of the political process and the administrative process. But it's a really critical part of how people divvy up water rights. So if you go to a state like Colorado or Arizona or Idaho, they'll have a water resources board. Usually folks are appointed and they have some insulation from the political process. So it's a little bit like AOGCC, where there's long terms, they have professional staff that really delve into these really critical and sensitive issues. You know, the history of Alaska is that we have mostly the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has come to the Department of Natural Resources, and where they saw a need to make sure that there was water in a stream, they've been the applicant for in-stream flow reservations, and we've issued hundreds of those around the states. And this is a big issue because, you know, we do need to protect water for salmon and water for conservation purposes in streams. And then on the other hand, we've had, you know, mostly folks from industry, the mining industry, come and ask DNR for a water appropriation. And so what we have is we have one state agency which is, you know, working through these applications, and sometimes they're competing, sometimes they're not. And you know, it's critical for people to know that over the history of the state, we've issued literally hundreds, and I certainly would be very happy to provide a list, hundreds of in-stream flow reservations, mostly to the Department of Fish and Game. They're the usual applicant. So that's where we stand as a state. It's something, too, that has really come into the consciousness of the public, in particular around ballot measure one. And, you know, one of the things that has been raised in that debate is whether the state knows how and is willing to issue an in-stream flow reservation to a nonprofit or not an agency. And the answer to that question is yes. And you know, what we have tried to point out to folks, but I think is really critically important, is that we issued four in-stream flow reservations to the Nature Conservancy at the Tulare Creek, which is one of the two streams implicated in the Pebble Mine proposal. Okay, there's the Kaktuli and there's the Tularic, and they came to us, the Nature Conservancy of Alaska, and they asked us to issue an in-stream flow reservation there for the particular purposes of protecting anadromous fish as well as resident fish, and we did so in 2017. So the system works. But it's a controversial system because, when you talk about water, first of all, water is critically important. I can't think, of a more critical asset that the state owns, and people are very rightly so, very, very focused on both water volumes and water quality. We're very fortunate because we stand here today and we've done a reasonably good job. We have the ability to issue in-stream flow reservations. We have the ability to issue appropriations, but we do need a better system. And like I said, my thought around that system is that there has to be a quasi-independent organization like the AOGCC that can evaluate applications for appropriation or in-stream flow reservation and then go through the process of issuing those. And I think that would be the best place for the state of Alaska.
And again, just kind of looking back a little bit, I wanted to sort of zero in on, you mentioned that both the state has received numerous in-stream flow reservations, and certainly not unheard of that a nonprofit organization or some other private group might receive those as well. But maybe you could sort of give us the kind of Reader's Digest, if that's not too dated a reference, the Reader's Digest version of how DNR comes to that decision of whether or not to grant an in-stream flow reservation. Is that a will issue, a shall issue? How does that work?
In the case of an in-stream flow reservation, it requires the application of an entity that qualifies as a person under the state law. And a person can be another state agency. It can be a federal agency. It could be a organization or a person who lives in Missouri. It's very broadly defined. But if a person, and certainly a nonprofit like the Nature Conservancy or the Tuitna Citizens Coalition or the Department of Fish and Game or the Bureau of Land Management, come to the state of Alaska, they have to meet certain elements of a statutory framework. And the most critical elements are there has to be a need for the in-stream flow reservation. And then it has to be in the public interest, and you have to show there's not that the in-stream flow reservation isn't impinging on an existing right. So most of these water applications, whether it's an appropriation or in-stream flow, operate under the premise of first in time, first in right. In other words, if somebody applies for the water, their application, once it's deemed complete, has first priority to get through the process. Anyway, they apply and they ask for a certain percentage of the water to be reserved for a particular purpose so they can show the need. And then here at DNR, we actually send it to the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, and there's a section within the Division of Mining, Land, and Water called the Water Resources Section, and they start the evaluation on the amount of flow. They look at other criteria, and mostly when they get an application from the Department of Fish and Game, that evaluation involves evaluating and ensuring that the fish that are present and using the stream, they're simply making sure that water is needed for that purpose. And then there would be a determination by the Water Resources Section, and they would issue, after they go through all the factual analysis, then they would issue a water certificate, and it literally is written like a certificate, almost like a certificate you would get if you were a good student. And, in the case of controversial issues, those are appealed, and they can be appealed directly to the commissioner's office, and then ultimately, if the appellants aren't satisfied, they can take it to state court.
And that's we're sort of in a part of that process now. But in talking about the department's role in analyzing applications, something that has popped up to me, especially with regards to the Chewitna situation, is this idea of trying to gauge what's appropriate or not. And there seems to be some conflict, maybe even within the department, about how to aggregate and how to figure out what is appropriate and for whom and to what purpose and those sorts of things. And maybe you could talk a little bit about how is that a sticking point in trying to make those determinations? Because as you've said, there are some things about what's on the books that are pretty vague. And I can get a little bit more specific. And as I've been kind of studying up and refreshing my own memory on this, again, specifically the Chewitna issue, and looking at some of the documents that are out there and been shuffled back and forth, I'm specifically looking at Dave Shady's letter to Doug Vincent Lang and regarding the appropriateness question. And
I think that what Dave is referring to that in his letter is that he's trying to follow the statute and the regulations and trying to be true to the law. And I think Mr. Vincent Lang's letter was really calling into question, and I don't have it in front of me, it was calling into question the appropriateness of issuing an in-stream flow reservation to an organization that had very clearly indicated its opposition to a particular project and wanted to stop a development project. And I think he was asking a question, which was where we have an organization which is not here for the specific purpose of keeping stream in a water for salmon, but instead trying to stop a project, is that appropriate? And Dave Shady, in his answer, and I think it was a good answer, said, and I'm absolutely simplifying this and dumbing it
Sure.
down, but he said, we're following a process which is laid out in statute and regulation, and they qualify as a person, and despite what their public intentions may or may not be, we're going to follow the law, and we're going to go through the criteria and the statutory framework that we have in front of us. That's, I've read those letters.
I guess, what that leads me to is sort of some bigger questions. As you mentioned, the youth of the state and the fact that Alaska is really pretty lucky to be considering these issues right now rather than looking back at what could have been, the way a lot of other states are doing, and spending hundreds of millions of dollars trying to get back what we still have. But I'm curious, as bigger projects are thought of and developed, and there's more and more exploration around the state for various resource development, do we begin to start to need to ask that question? And it's a complicated and very difficult question about prioritizing resources, because as we know, constitutionally in Alaska, we don't like to prioritize one resource over the other. But as the state grows and as the ambitions of how to develop the state and its resource grow, you have, at least from my end, you have to start wondering if that really well-intentioned and that well-intentioned goal of not prioritizing one resource over the other, if that's always going to be able to hold. Do you see, as bigger projects are thought of, is that becoming an issue of the prioritization of various resources?
That's a really good question. We as a state have to accept that moving forward, we're in a great position, but there is going to be conflict. And I think on a regional basis, we absolutely need to prioritize what we want to do. And I think the notion that there is unlimited multiple use in every single region of the state, I think that would lead to more conflict. And so when it comes to a region like Bristol Bay, you really have to ask, and the state has to ask itself a fundamental question, is what is the highest use and the best use for a region like Bristol Bay? And if you look at its history, it's been a fishing district. So I think that we do have to grapple with this, and we need to get beyond some very vague notion that every district, every region, every area, every water body, every inland area, can sustain unlimited industrial sport subsistence activity. We're growing as a state. There's more activity. that just isn't realistic. And so we have to make some tough decisions. And I think we will need to identify areas in the state where, when you ask yourself a very basic question, what is the best use? What should be the priority in that region? You come to some conclusions and then you go in that direction. And I think it has to be done. You know, the one thing I will say too, and you're not asking this question, but I'm going to give you my thought on it, is, you know, when it comes to resource development, the Department of Natural Resources has always been placed in the lead role because we have the statutory framework, we have the constitutional mandate to go out and develop the resources of the state of Alaska. But I think that there has to be some sort of rebalance where fishing game as a department, which is, you know, tasked with managing on a sustainable basis the fisheries in Alaska, has an equal role when it comes to resource management in Alaska. And that includes water and that includes land. And, you know, frankly, we've centralized as a state the resource development mandate and DNR, but it has created a situation where people who are reliant upon fish, that's their resource, have felt left out of the process. And that, in the long run, is not something that we want to do as a state. I think as a state, we want to make sure that people whose livelihoods and lives, you know, in a subsistence sense or in a sport fishing context, are reliant upon the fisheries, feel like they're included and, in fact, are included in the decision-making process. And that's the future that I see in Alaska. And it takes a little rebalance.
I wanted to ask if and this is sort of staying on that same general idea, and especially as we think about things like the Stand for Salmon Initiative, which you brought up. And I'll give you a little bit of context of where I'm coming from. In conversations that I've had with, you know, fish and game folks and folks that I know in DNR and even folks who have worked in permitting, there seems to be some recognition that, again, as the state grows up, a bridge here, an airport there, a culvert there, these are all relatively small projects that the state is more than capable of handling and coming to agreements, whether it's with the Department of Transportation or whatever the entity is, to make those smaller scale projects work. I'm curious what you think is the capacity for the Department of Natural Resources to handle these ever increasing scale sized projects when the reality is the Department of Natural Resources, when it comes to employees, isn't growing by any means. How would you describe the capacity to handle that now and into the future?
We're constrained by resources to thoroughly evaluate the applications that we have now. And this notion that, you know, we should continue to cut state government and that's the answer, I disagree with that. I think that people expect that we'll grapple with these issues, that we'll thoroughly and carefully consider applications for in-stream flow, for water appropriations, and many, many other issues. And we need more resources to do it. And eventually over time, if there's more people in Alaska, there's more proposed activity, we have to address that need. But I think you hit on something very important, is that we're definitely, as a state, at the front end of this, and no one project really makes or breaks a watershed, a fishery. But we have to accept that the level of impact cumulatively will eventually put us in a particular spot. And we as Alaskans need to be very cognizant of that. And, you know, while we look at individual projects, we have to really look larger. And particularly here in Cook Inlet, you know, you go to the Kenai Peninsula and you look at the activity around the Kenai River, the Kasilof River, and then you go up in the valley and the drainage is there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a lifelong Alaskan born in Soldotna, and mm-hmm. there's no doubt that these drainages are impacted by the cumulative activities along them. And salmon seem to be extremely resilient. In fact, in some years when there's a lot of salmon that have come back, I'm impressed. They seem to do so with lots of distraction and lots of things going on around them and lots of activities on their in their habitat. But we're very, very fortunate. And but you know, I just don't see how we can't think forward 10 and 20 years and figure out where we want to be. You know, the one thing I know I don't want to be as a lifelong Alaskan is where Oregon is at, or the state of Washington is at, where it seems like they've had some difficulties with their fisheries.
Ron, I'm curious, you know, from your perspective as someone who lives in and subsists on the west side of Cook Inlet over by Beluga, talk a little bit about what this issue means to you and why it's important.
Well, my family's been here for years and years, and part of what their income derived from was fishing. And they started off doing that out of boats and drifting, and then eventually, as they got older, did more beach fishing. The income and stuff in our family was very important, that we had salmon and that we tried to maintain a decent return every year, whether it was by, you know, taking care of the spawning grounds or protecting the spawning grounds and or watching how much escapement we had. And so the next year and the year after that, we would have plenty of fish. And then along comes the mining issues. And a lot of people think, well, mining is just that. You know, they just go in and dig the dirt up and take the dirt they want and leave the dirt behind that they don't want. It's not how it works. I mean, a lot of times they may dig down 200 or 300 feet. And in that 200 or 300 feet of digging, they went through salmon streams, water canals or channels in the ground, whether it be for wells or just flowing water. I mean, our subsoils are full of all kinds of minerals and things, and our water is one of them. So that was where we got into this issue of keeping water in our streams, our salmon streams, to make sure that our salmon always had enough water to spawn. And it takes 3 years, you know, for a salmon to reach the age where they make the run to the ocean. And then 3 to 4 years later, they come back and the cycle starts again.
You know, I'm wondering, for folks who have never been to that part of the state, never been across the inlet over there, I was hoping maybe you could help us understand a little bit better about what things look like, how the conditions are around that Middle Creek area, Middle Creek being the one of the main portions that would have been affected by this decision had it been held up and those sorts of things. Tell us a little bit about what Middle Creek is and how those fish runs are and those sorts of things.
And that's really a good question, too, is Middle Creek is right in the middle between Lone Creek and Lone Ridge. And so that whole area is kind of a swampy, even though high, because we have high elevation swamps in Alaska, which a lot of mountainous countries don't have that. But ours is. Ours is a high, wet area, and underneath that area is the coal. And the coal, the mother load of the coal, is 350 feet deep. And the way salmon streams work is they never freeze. In the wintertime, the water, the groundwater, comes up through and hits the stream, keeps the fish that are in there alive, and then runs on out. There's always some water running out of a river in Alaska, froze or not. So it's real important that water stays in there so those fish stay alive. They were going to mine through 14 miles of Middle Creek, and Middle Creek is just above Lone Creek, so it would have killed Lone Creek, too. What we wanted to do, what we proposed to do, is we applied, we spent $4,500 and applied for a permit to keep water in the creek, not to take water out. Now, you can get a permit to take water out of a creek, which is what the mining company wanted to do, and they issued them that permit right off the bat. Just boom, it was okay. Now, when we did this, then it's been 9 years we've been fighting to get this permit to keep water in the creek so our fish could live. There's no fishing up there where this is. This is all spawning area. You know, it's way down. It's oh gosh, probably half, three quarters of a mile below where Middle Creek comes in to Lone Creek, where you can fish, legally fish. So up where we're talking, you can't fish. It's like it's not greed that we're doing this. No one, these fish are for everyone. No one can go up there and fish. It's all for the spawning of our fish and for our fishermen and the people working in the industry and us to get some every year. If I like to eat fish, then that's one of the nice things about Alaska. We can go catch a pretty nice salmon and put them on the grill. So that's why we fought this fight. It wasn't anything else. It wasn't we wanted to stop mining. We wanted to stop. We just wanted to stop the deterioration of our state. It's so important that if we don't save some of the natural resources like our water and our salmon streams, there won't be anything left.
You know, I'm glad you brought up specifically the fact that that a lot of this work is being planned or had been being planned for spawning grounds, because that's kind of a different animal than if you're talking about a little bit closer, you know, to out in the ocean. If you're talking a little bit closer to the river mouth, that spawning ground area is a much more delicate area than other parts of the watershed for, you know, downstream.
Yes, that's very true. I mean, and the reason why it was protected by our forefathers and our Constitution was because of that. The fry are so fragile, and they don't want people walking through them. They don't want four-wheelers running through them, you know, boats, nothing. Because these creeks, most of these creeks, like Middle Creek, it's not very wide, and it's not very deep. It's probably a little over knee deep most of the way and 3 or 4 foot wide. But it's down. You look down, even like this time of year before the snow hits, and it'll be 4 feet from the cut bank to the bottom of that creek. So when it snows, it might snow like this winter. It's very possible to get 20 feet of snow over that creek. That whole basin up in there is where the bears go and den and stuff. It's like Mother Nature's best. I mean, when we talk about things that we don't want to destroy in Alaska, these are some of the things that we do not want to destroy. And then when I came up here in 1980, the Wetlands Act was really strong. I mean, you could not go out there until it was froze up. Some of it had to have a certain amount of snow cover. And now they're talking about just destroying it all. I mean, what you give me a destroy something? I'm not talking about destroying it and then 20 years will be better. It'll never be better again, ever.
You know, in talking about, you know, applying for this in-stream flow and trying to essentially, it's exactly as it sounds, reserve that water for another purpose, in this case, reserve it for salmon. And in my conversation with the commissioner, the hitching point seemed to kind of be this idea that when do you reserve that water? When is it appropriate to reserve that water for some purpose, be it for mining, be it for fish, be it for whatever? And it got me to thinking that this idea that is sort of baked into the way we do things in Alaska, that we try really hard to not prioritize one resource over another, one group over another, that sort of thing. As bigger projects like this are proposed and thought about and applied for even, I begin to wonder if that still holds true, if Alaska can sort of have its cake and eat it too and not prioritize one resource over another and be able to keep them all. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, if you don't take care of something, it'll be gone and be gone forever. I mean, we've done this. And we've got groups of people now that save certain groups of animals that are starting to get on the endangered list. And this endangered list is real, whether it be fish, water, humans, it's all the same. If we don't protect it, we lose it. It is gone. That word lose is a big, big word that's only got a few letters in it. That means when it's gone, it is gone. And we don't want that to happen to Alaska. We're trying our darndest to keep that from happening. And the hunters and the fishermen and the boating people that just you know, just like to go out and have a good time, maybe sail or you know, get out in the water and do their thing. But we need to protect those rights. And along with those rights are things that so-and-so's little country store down in Sterling, it sells, you know, it sells supplies to somebody going to the river and fishing, you know, or they're down there camping and they just needed a bag of charcoal, you know, to get their cook fire going. You know, it's all money and it all keeps the wheel turning. And if we don't protect that right and that way of life, it's gone. And when we say gone, it is, look at Europe. I mean, just all we got to do is look at our forefathers. And they destroyed the fish, they destroyed the water, and it's 400 years or 500 years in the making, and they can't get it back. You know, so, and it wasn't even done on purpose. We know when we're not doing anything about it. These people didn't know that when they dug up the land around the farm, this rich ground around the rivers, that when the rains came, it was going to wash all the topsoil into the river. They didn't know that. And when it did it, it killed fish. They didn't know that. We know it now. We've studied it. We've had 400 or 500 years of information come to us from the old country. And all we got to do is believe. I mean, we don't have to just figure it out for now. We just got to believe it.
There is that incredible history that you can look at of what folks have done right and wrong. But what strikes me is you don't have to look back that far here in the United States, especially on the Pacific coast. You can look back just a few generations in other places down Washington, Oregon, California, those places, and see that they were facing the same questions, and you would think that that would shed some light on how we should make decisions here in Alaska, but I don't know if that's really happening.
Well, it's not happening, and the reason why it's not happening, and you remember this, I don't know how old you are, but I'm 70, and we have known for a long time that the industries do not want the people to have any say in what they do. They want to be able to do anything and everything, destroying it, it doesn't matter. All they want is to get that product out of the ground, get that mineral or oil or whatever it is, and sell it and get more and sell it and get more and sell it. They don't care the aftermath at all. They don't care. They say they do. They don't. You know, they donate money to help out different projects because that makes them look good. Without doing that, they don't look so good. Mm-hmm. So that's the only reason why they do it.
Looking at this issue, and now, you know, this one's, of course, been going on for a number of years, and now coming up in the November elections, there's another big question that's very much, I think, related to this, the Stand for Salmon Initiative. Mm-hmm. I wonder, as someone who's out there and trying to really make a stand on an issue like this, do you find that, and I have to imagine that you do, find that there is... that these big issues, when they come up, that there is an opportunity there for the state legislature to weigh in and start making some adjustments and some changes to some of these laws that do allow these things to happen, to get with the times a little bit. The laws that are on the books are pretty old and seem to not be satisfying everyone anymore. Is there an opportunity there for the legislature, or is this going to have to happen through citizens' hard work?
Well, it happens through our legislation. But I don't think it will, because we have so much private interest as far as big companies and stuff go that they're down there with lobbyists and stuff and you know, bending the ear of everybody that'll listen on all these things. And that's when bad stuff happens. And, you know, they donate any amount of money they want for anybody running for government. You know, it's wrong. I mean, they're not a person, but now they get treated like one because of the laws that were allowed to be passed. And that's the same thing that happened to our coastal management. You know, the big companies, the big oil companies, and that they didn't want coastal management to be in place because that restricted them. You take a crane and you dig into the side of our inlet, you get fined, or you could be fined. Not now, because we have no government entity to fine you. So they're going to have to reinvent the wheel, so to speak, now in order to get any teeth in something that somebody does wrong. So the next step is to pass a law, or if they've got their permitting done and they was allowed to dig up our salmon streams, that would set a precedent that would eventually kill everything. And what I tell people on the Kenai, because this is across the inlet, we're in the Kenai Borough over there, but we're across the inlet. But, you know, if it can happen on one side, it can happen on the other. And there's just as much coal under the Kenai River as there under the Kuit River. What's good about, you know, the attractiveness to the west side was they don't have anybody over there, really. They got the little village of Tainioni, but there's only about 100 people there now year-round. And then on the north of that, there's only 12 of the families that are on the north side of the Beluga, or the Theodore River, and up between the Theodore and Kuit. Most of those people are just workers. You know, they're just on shift. And for the most part, those guys do a good job. I mean, they weren't like miners. You know, miners, what they were doing was killing everything. And what there's lots and lots of things in place now for the oil and gas industry. And from what we see, they do a pretty good job.
Ron, I wanted to ask you also, you know, getting back specifically to this this latest, I guess, round of action with DNR and your organization. What was your thought when Commissioner Mack came out and said, you know, I know we granted you this this water right, we granted you this reservation, but now that the project's off the table, we're going to change our minds. What did you think about that decision? How did you feel about that?
That is the way the law works. You know, once we did it, we did everything by the law. We paid them the money. They accepted the money. They took their good old time making a decision. They made the decision in our favor. And then the coal company decided there's no market for the coal right now. And so they pulled out and left. And the commissioner's saying because of that action that they made, there's now no threat on the river, and there's no sense in us giving the CCC their water rights. Now, does that increase or what?
The fact that this particular proposal is off the table, that's not necessarily the point. It wasn't necessarily about this one proposal.
No, it's for saving the future. It's all that, see, if we don't take these steps now, afterwards, too late. It's too late. Once God makes something, man shouldn't screw a lot with it, because he can mess it up to where it never comes back.
You know, looking back at some of the other legal parts of this whole thing that have gone on the last many years, the courts have been fairly friendly to your side of this argument and your side of this issue. How are you feeling about this latest appeal? How do you think the courts are going to weigh?
Well, I'm definitely hoping they get it right and support the law the way it's written. And that's, you know, if we're going to change that, then it has to be changed in the books. The law right now is very clear. We should get our award of this, should be given to us, and the Alaska people can rest. You know, they don't have to worry about somebody coming in and destroying something without due process. And due process is what we're going through on this right now. It shouldn't have to do this every single time there's something comes up, you know. That's the reason why we want this law in place. We want to get a law that says you can't mine through a salmon stream, and this water has to stay there for the salmon. And this is what's beautiful about Alaska, is there is nothing up there. This is just wildlife at its finest. So it's really nice to be able to have part of our world that every little bug and creature can live and survive without it being destroyed. If you make a law, then why are we fighting so hard to enforce those laws? I don't get that part of it. It's a law. You broke it. Okay, you pay a fine or whatever. This is all we're doing here. Our people in government, in the DNR, should be way busier than this to have to deal with something like this over and over again because somebody doesn't like it. That's all it is. And again, it's going to be what our fish are really worth to us. Do we want to keep our fish or not?
And a final question for DNR Commissioner Andy Mack. The Chewitna Citizens Coalition, of course, filed an appeal. What's next in that process?
Well, I think this is a case where my decision in August was really focused on the fact that the asset itself, the proposed coal mine, is owned by the Mental Health Trust Authority. And I want to make sure, and we have an obligation to the Mental Health Trust Authority. The short history there is we were sued in the, I believe it was the late 80s, early 90s, and after a bit of litigation, the state reaffirmed its obligation and its commitment to the Mental Health Trust Authority. They have 1 million acres statewide, which they develop on behalf of their beneficiaries, mm-hmm. where people with, you know, mental disabilities and dementia and many of the other issues involving mental health. And so I want to make sure that they get the benefit of that agreement in the early 90s. And I think it's time to sit down and try to settle this so that that area can potentially be protected, that the trust authority can meet their obligation, and that the folks in particular who live in Tyonek and the tribal members who are subsistence harvesters can feel comfortable that they're going to have access to fisheries and access to activities which they have historically enjoyed. So I hope that the litigation and all the decision-making, and the rhetoric dies down, because in my mind, this is, I'm very fond of Cook Inlet, and this particular area is a very, very unique area. And, I sense that there's a possibility there could be some solution there, but it takes cooperation on the parts of all people who are really focused on this, and it's going to take some negotiation and some discussion, and hopefully we can put the Mental Health Trust in a good spot, and we can solve it across the table as opposed to in a courtroom.